last time. This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is December 2nd, 1994. I'm in Ted Finman's office in the law school for, I think this is, my goodness, our fifth or sixth interview session.
Is that right?
Yeah. And we're going to answer, talk about a few things regarding the athletic board, which we talked about at the after our last session had ended. And then we're going to go on to talk about First Amendment issues today. One of the things you mentioned, Ted, after the microphone went off last week, or 2 weeks ago, was regarding the Chancellor Shalala and a lunch session you had with her.
Yeah, this occurred during the controversy over the athletic department's proposal to cut five sports. And the Chancellor was supporting that. And invited me in to have lunch with her to talk about it, an opportunity which I welcomed because I hoped to convince her in my direction, and she, of course, wanted to convince me to support the proposal. It's unusual for her to do that sort of thing in my experience. That is, in terms of my relations with her, it was unusual.
To call you in personally?
Right.
Like that?
Yeah. I mean, we had talked personally on various occasions, but this was a bit more elaborate to have lunch brought into her office and ask me to come in. In any event, we had a pleasant lunch and presented our different perspectives. Neither of us convinced the other, not surprisingly, and left agreeing to disagree.
What was her basic argument that she presented to you, do you recall?
I don't really recall, but I expect it was the budgetary argument, because that was the argument being made by the department.
Mm-hmm. The one other issue you wanted to bring up this time was regarding Penn State's addition into the Big Ten.
Yes, this was a fairly important and controversial matter. Serena Pondrum of the English department and I were the UW representatives to the faculty representatives to the Big Ten. And in my experience, and I think that of others, it had always been standard practice if the heads of the Big Ten institutions had some idea about doing something significant, that they would first discuss it both with the athletic directors and the faculty representatives of their various institutions. However, that procedure was not followed in this case. The heads of the institutions apparently had discussed this matter among themselves and decided to invite Penn State to join the Big Ten without even discussing it with their athletic directors, leave alone with the faculty representatives. That was very surprising because, of course, adding an 11th school to the Big Ten has a very substantial impact on scheduling, especially when the 11th school is at a fairly substantial distance from most of the other institutions and in a location that's not so easy to get to, which is the case with Penn State. In any event, when this became known at the very next meeting of the Big Ten faculty representatives and athletic directors, there was a real hue and cry about the failure to consult. And both Serena and I were rather vociferous about this, what we considered a serious breach of proper process. And I think that probably was an important factor in the Chancellor's subsequent decision to limit the terms of faculty representatives to the Big Ten, I think it was to 3 years, which meant that Bo Serena's term and mine would soon be over. She was very unhappy with the fact that we had taken such a strong position contrary to what she was doing.
But certainly you weren't alone.
Oh, no, no.
Excuse me.
All of the faculty representatives to the Big Ten objected strongly to the way in which this had been done.
Why was it done? Were they afraid that you would reject it? Or?
I have no idea why they proceeded in that fashion. And I don't know to whom that process, as opposed to the normal one, should be attributed.
That's really a curious thing. Well, that's something I can certainly ask the chancellor the former chancellor when I interview her sometime.
Sure.
Yeah. I'd like to turn now to an area that you have devoted a good part of your career toward, and that's the relating to First Amendment issues. And as an active university citizen, you have managed to entered into several of the debates over the years regarding the First Amendment. And the way it's used or abused here on campus. Let's talk first a little bit about your interest in the First Amendment. Where did this spring, and a little bit about how it has developed over your years here at Madison?
Well, my strong convictions about the importance of free speech go way, way back, if not to high school days, at least to college days, and I've always had a strong conviction about the importance of maintaining freedom of speech ever since then.
Did this translate into classroom teaching or anything while you were here? Or research interests?
Actually both. In the late 60s, I developed and for a good number of years taught a seminar in political free speech problems, focused on anti-war protests, civil rights protests, taking up questions of civil disobedience and a whole range of questions, but focusing on political free speech. And then Stuart McCauley and I wrote that the article that involving free speech issues.
Yeah, we have talked about some of this earlier right. Parts of the interview. There are some interesting incidents that have occurred on campus that you have become involved with that we haven't talked about, however, and that do involve the First Amendment. The first one I have on my list, and I'm sorry if these may not be in the correct order, but regards to Memorial Union and the display of Playboy magazine in the Union. Could you talk about how you, the development of that issue and your involvement in it?
Well, I don't recall the details of just exactly the sequence of events that got me involved in it. I heard that the Union, I guess directorate or whatever body has authority over the sale of magazines in the Union, that they had decided to eliminate Playboy on the ground that don't know that I can state exactly, but something of the idea that it was highly offensive to women and that it communicated bad messages about women, that it was demeaning to women. I viewed that as the decision to take it off for those reasons as a clear violation of First Amendment principles and values. You have to take into account that this is not just a private bookstore. The union is a part of the University of Wisconsin, which means that what it does is action by government. And so this, in my eyes, represented an act of government censorship because of the message that a publication was communicating. And that indeed was the explicit, at least one of the explicit reasons for removing Playboy. And I don't remember whether, I think Bernie Cohen must have been acting chancellor, and Bri Curl may have been acting vice chancellor for academic affairs. Or if Bernie was still vice chancellor for academic affairs, Bri was much involved in helping Bernie. In any event, I must have raised the issue with Bernie, who I knew quite well as a faculty colleague and as a personal friend. And eventually Bernie asked me to chair a committee to look into the matter, which I did.
Now, your initial involvement was talking to Bernie. You did this on your own. You just had learned about this, and you approached him voluntarily.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I was moderately outraged by what they were doing. And so that's why I raised it. And formed a committee. I don't recall exactly who else was on it. The committee made a report dealing with the issues of the selection of magazines for the union and what would be permissible criteria and what not. And I remember talking a good deal with Bri Curl, who I think was quite helpful on these matters. And that pretty much exhausts my recollection of it.
Did you work with the union people at all? Did you talk to them about their
perception? Oh, we must have. I'm sure we talked to the union people and heard from them about why they did what they did. And I'm sure we talked to Ted Crabb, for example. I don't have any specific recollection of those conversations.
What was the resolution then?
The ultimate resolution was that Playboy went back on the stands, as I recall.
I wonder how long that lasted, because it's not on the stands at present. That would be an interesting thing to follow up on. Perhaps I should ask Ted.
Crap. Yeah, are you sure it's not available in brown cover? No, I'm serious.
I know for a while they took it off. And they had it underneath, and if you ask for it, they sold it to you. But I haven't. I pick up my paper there. My times are every morning. I'll ask them if the desk people if they know what happened.
Well, the principle involved, or the principle, First Amendment principles involved, don't require the union magazine stand to carry any particular publication.
Mm-hmm.
What's offensive is if they make a decision about whether to carry a publication on the basis of the content of the messages it communicates. And as I recall, the report dealt with how they should make decisions. So, it would be perfectly permissible for them to have criteria that would exclude Playboy and various other magazines if those criteria were neutral with respect to the content of the publication and applied in an honestly neutral way. So if they don't have Playboy at the moment, I would assume that it was as a result of applying in a fair and honest way some content neutral criteria. For example, how much demand there is for it.
Mm-hmm. I remember that was an issue that made the Cardinal and the student papers, at least. Did you receive any flack or support or anything like that because of your stand on this, or was it pretty quiet?
I don't recall receiving any particular flack.
Okay. Moving on to the next issue, you were you served as chair of an ad hoc committee that drafted faculty rules on sexual harassment.
Right.
Could you talk about that for a little bit, how you got involved?
Sure. And there's a certain small irony in this instance, as well as in my involvement later on with the hate speech, so-called hate speech rules. In both instances, I became involved upon learning about some proposals for rules which I felt violated First Amendment principles and values. And that is, I became involved in opposition to rules that were being proposed and ended up playing a large part in drafting rules that were ultimately adopted. But the rules that were drafted and were adopted were very, very different than the proposals that motivated my involvement. And obviously, in my judgment, what was ultimately adopted did not violate First Amendment principles. Mm-hmm. So coming back now to the faculty rules, I don't recall the exact time, but it was a period in which various proposals were being made in various contexts about sexual harassment. It was a big thing in the workplace, that is, in industrial and other commercial workplaces, that there was federal legislation, the federal agencies were proposing, or had proposed rules against sexual harassment in industrial and commercial workplaces. And there was a committee in the university, I don't remember whether it was a Madison committee or a system committee. I think it was probably a system committee, but I'm not sure, that was working on a proposal which essentially adopted the model that had been developed for private enterprise, for the private enterprise context. And when I saw that, I again became very much concerned about it, and other people were concerned about it. And Irv Shane was chancellor at that time. I must have talked with Irv about it, and that led to the appointment of this committee and his request that I chair it.
You talked to Irv expressing your concern about
yes,
that sort of thing.
Right.
And did, as you recall, did Chancellor Shane express his own concern back, or was he neutral on it, or?
I don't recall Irv's exact response, but I, without meaning to be immodest, I think his reaction would have been that if I and others felt this kind of concern, then at least there was something to look at more carefully. But it was I remember some of the people who were on the committee, and it was a very good committee, I think. And two things happened for me on the committee. First, I became educated by other people on the committee about things that were happening by way of various forms of sexual harassment. so that I gained an appreciation of the problem that I hadn't had before. And you know, that led me to believe that it would be appropriate to write some faculty rules, that there were some things that needed to be addressed. Some of them really don't raise any kind of First Amendment problems at all, and really involve principles beyond sexual harassment, and maybe principles of academic integrity that would suffice to warrant regulation without any concern about sexual harassment. The business of faculty members offering grades or other advantages for sex obviously involves matters of academic integrity. Mm-hmm. And those things were relatively easy. The difficult problem and the First Amendment problem had to do with the use of language or illustrative material that was would be highly offensive to women students and make them uncomfortable in a class situation. That's the concern on one side, and obviously the concern on the other side was a matter of First Amendment and academic freedom. We managed, in my judgment, to develop some rules which imposed some, I think, very carefully drafted regulations that reached only a very narrow category of communicative activity that could be reached without offending First Amendment or academic freedom concerns. And those, after a fair amount of debate, were ultimately adopted by the Faculty Senate and exist to this day.
Can you recall enough to summarize what that was, what those the intent was? At least?
Yeah, you can find a copy of them, which would be the best way
we'll
to get their content.
We will do that, and we will put it in your file for people listening to this tape at a future date.
Okay. The version that exists today, I believe, covers not only faculty but also academic staff, and at some point a few years after the faculty rules were adopted, the academic staff decided to consider the matter, and the academic staff people who were working on that talked with me about the faculty rules and adopted essentially the same provision, so that they're now combined.
Was this a provision that you and the committee came up with on your own? Did you use any other? Were there other provisions in other universities, for example, or within the system that you?
No, I'm. These are ours.
They're.
I think they're probably unique. And you know, very detailed, both as to what limitations were being imposed on speech and on the process that would be used if claims of harassment were made under these rules. Let me just kind of highlight, as best I can recall, some of the main features of the rules. The exact language, as we said before, you'll get. One thing we did was to distinguish between speech in an instructional setting and street speech in a non-instructional setting. We made that distinction because the concern about academic freedom exists primarily in instructional settings.
Mm-hmm.
It would exist, of course, in connection with research and so on, but we didn't address we didn't attempt to make any rules. There didn't seem to be any, no one was proposing any rules except in instructional settings and to a lesser extent in non-instructional settings. I'm trying to, if you want to wait a second, I can probably grab a copy.
Sure. I'll... Okay, go on.
Okay, I've now tried to refresh my memory of the particular provisions by reading through the present document, which incorporates the rules that were adopted pursuant to our committee's recommendation and later adopted by the academic staff. That document bears the identification Roman numeral 2-303 and is entitled Prohibited Harassment, Definitions and Rules Governing the Conduct of UW-Madison Faculty and Academic Staff. I mentioned before that the rules we developed distinguished between instructional and non-instructional settings, and that we made that distinction because of the especially acute concern for free speech and academic freedom in instructional settings. Let me just say a word quickly about what that distinction is as it was developed in these rules. An instructional setting is one in which faculty are communicating with students about some matter that faculty are responsible for teaching students. And that can occur in a classroom, in a lab, on a field trip, in an office, but the essential defining characteristic is that the faculty is talking to the student about something that was is within the faculty member's teaching responsibility as opposed to anything else. We did impose a very, very narrowly defined limitation on speech in the instructional setting. We imposed it because we were aware of various incidents in which faculty members would use in a way that had really no, as far as we could see, no legitimate claim to academic freedom protection. They used pictures of nude women or use examples that were extremely offensive to women in the class and would make the situation a difficult one for women in the class and interfere with their ability to learn effectively in that setting, because the things being done, and there weren't very many of these, but there were enough that it was a matter of concern, but the things being done would be highly embarrassing or disturbing to women, and we saw no reason for allowing those things to occur, provided that there was no legitimate claim that it was important to be able to use these examples for pedagogical purposes. And so what the rules say, to kind of summarize it, is that if the faculty member claims that the expressive activity in question is germane to the subject matter of the teaching, then it's immune from discipline unless an appropriate hearing body, which would be a faculty body, finds that that claim of germaneness is, quote, clearly unreasonable. And secondly, if it's germane and the faculty member claims that there isn't an equally or virtually equally effective way to communicate, to accomplish the pedagogical purpose that is not offensive. If the faculty member makes that claim, then again, the activity is immune from discipline unless that claim is found to be clearly unreasonable by a faculty hearing body. And with those very substantial qualifications, we felt that the rule could be used effectively in the rarely rare instances in which a faculty member did something in a instructional setting that the cross-section of faculty would consider pretty outrageous and having nothing to do with effective teaching.
To your knowledge, have there been many disputes that have arisen since this, claims by students?
At most, over the years, a handful, really very, very few.
What would be the penalty, or what has been the penalty for a professor who was found to be?
I don't know what has been, but another thing that's important to recognize is that one of the requirements that has to be satisfied before discipline could be imposed would be that the person engaging in the conduct had been asked not to do so and had continued to do so nonetheless. And another finding that would be required before discipline is that the conduct seriously interferes with the academic work of a student and makes, or that it makes the instructional setting hostile for some students.
Well, Ted and I will walk down to the office after this session and we'll make a Xerox of that rule.
Sure.
And we'll put it in the folder for people who want to study it more closely. You said that it was a good committee and there were some committee members you remember. Who were some of the other people who were actively involved on that committee, do you recall?
Well, one person I know because she's a personal friend is Marjorie Klein, who's a member of the, she's a psychologist who is a faculty member in the Department of Psychiatry. And I believe Susan Friedman from English was on the committee. I can picture some of the other people, but I can't remember their names.
Well, I was just wondering, I'd like to maybe talk to some of them about this. This is a
sure.
really interesting issue. Anything
I'm
more?
Sure the full committee list of committee members is available.
I'll be able to find that. Anything else you care to say about that particular ad hoc committee?
I think that pretty much covers it.
One of the most emotional issues on campus in recent years, on campuses, college campuses in general, not only UW, in the last decade or so, has to do with what has come to be called hate speech codes. Just like with Vietnam, Madison has ended up playing a central role in that nationwide debate. I'm not going to go into detail or have you go into detail about the many incidents that were perceived as racist that occurred on the campus that brought this issue to the forefront. I'm going to enclose an article from the Los Angeles Times where it gives, I think, at least a pretty good outline of the types of events that were happening on campus. We will talk a little bit about that, but not specifically today. So people can go and read that article, or certainly go back and read the newspapers from that time period to get a good idea. But let me attempt a summary, which you can amend in any way you'd like, and simply say that especially revolved around several of the fraternities on campus who had at best construction thoughtless themes and parties that black students on campus felt demeaned their ethnicity. And as a result of that, some complaints were brought forward. And let's start right there. Let's start with the chancellor. Donna Shalala had recently come on board as chancellor at that point. This was in 1980. Oh gosh, I'm not going to say it because I'll get it wrong. Check the thing. But how did this first come to your attention? How did it first come into the code?
Well, there was a UW system committee that was working on the development of a code. And one of my colleagues, Arlen Christensen, was a member of that committee. And I believe that I learned about what the system committee was thinking of proposing from Arlen, and became concerned because the proposals of the system committee would have permitted discipline for speech or other expressive conduct addressed to the public would have allowed discipline of that because of the content of the message. And that, of course, strikes right at the heart of First Amendment principles. And I don't recall whether Gordon Baldwin became independently aware of this or whether I brought it to Gordon's attention, but in any event, both of us agreed that the things the system committee was contemplating, and I think Arlen was concerned about this too, went far beyond what would be permissible. And so once again, I got involved, not as someone taking the initiative to develop rules, but because of concern that initiatives that were being taken were going far beyond what should be permissible under free speech principles. So Gordon and I got in touch with Pat Hodelick in system administration, one of the lawyers in the legal office in system administration, who was working with the system committee, and she was also concerned. We had various conversations with her and others, and ultimately developed a proposal that was acceptable to the system committee and which we felt was appropriately limited, mm-hmm. that would not offend First Amendment principles. Richard Delgado, who was then a member of the law school faculty, was also involved. He had been involved in developing the, or in lobbying with the system committee for proposals that would have gone further. But I guess we were able to convince him to go with a more limited proposal as well.
Just give me an example of what going further meant.
Once again, if we can stop for a moment, I can get the relevant documents.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, I now have in front of me a document dated January 4, 1989, which is a communication to the members of the system committee that was working on this matter, which contains the language that the system committee at that time had decided to go with. And a copy of this was sent to Pat Hodelick, and she in turn, with a little handwritten note, sent it to Gordon Baldwin and me with a little note that we'd get together and discuss it. Now let me turn to the language that we found troubling. This document, this proposal, would have prohibited intentional racist or discriminatory conduct, including verbal conduct, that explicitly demeans, I won't read it all, explicitly demeans race, etc., and has the purpose or effect, emphasize or effect, of interfering with the education of a university student, etc. Or the purpose or effect, no, pardon me, or creates an intimidating, hostile, or demeaning environment for education, and so on. What that language would have covered, for example, would be a speech in which someone was criticizing Catholicism, for example, or saying the Pope is a tyrant, etc., 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 because it's not limited in any way to personal insults. It isn't limited to a situation even in which the speaker's intent is to demean, because all that's required is that the expressive activity have the purpose or effect of interfering. Now, this was an incredibly broad proposal. It just would have placed all kinds of limitations on public speeches, public debate, and so on.
So you had that meeting with Pat Hodulik, I assume?
More than one.
Yeah. And were her concerns, did she have those concerns to begin with? Is that why she sent that to you?
I think we had spoken before, but Pat certainly was concerned about this because, first of all, it clearly violates First Amendment principles. I don't think there's would have been much doubt about that at all. And I think Pat was opposed to it not only because it would be unconstitutional, but I believe that she believed with us that it would be bad policy as well.
And this was devised by a committee of central administration people?
Well, people from around the university. I have the list of the committee members here, and you can make a copy
we'll make
of
a
this
copy
if you
of this
wish,
as well,
too. There was, let me just see, as I said, there was my call, looks like eight people on the committee, two of whom were faculty. One, my colleague Arlen Christensen from Madison, another person who was a faculty member at Parkside, two students, and the rest administrators.
So your advice upon talking with Pat was to can that or to point out these serious shortcomings.
Right.
And is that when you got drafted into drafting your a revision of it?
I think Gordon and I must have worked together to come up with some far more limited proposal and would go over it with Pat. She would have suggestions. We worked together on that.
And did you come up with?
What we came up with was a proposal that prohibited the use, again, to summarize it quickly, essentially prohibited the use of, for example, racial epithets in the context in which one person was directing something specifically to another specific individual as a personal insult, so that this proposal in no way constrained public debate, public speeches, articles in student newspapers, and so on. It applied only when one person was directing a personal insult specific to another specific individual.
Is that the fighting words thing? Is that
Our legal argument was based on the fighting words doctrine. It didn't require, as the fighting words doctrine does, that the epithet be likely to provoke an immediate violent response. Because if you put that requirement in, then if the epithets are being directed by a large man to a small woman, to state the most obvious mm-hmm. kind of example, it's not likely to provoke an immediate violent response, and so the language or the conduct in that situation would not be prohibited under the rule. But the basic rationale for the fighting words doctrine is that in this personal insult situation, the language being used has nothing whatsoever to do with any effort to pursue an idea, since there's no likelihood of interchange when a white student calls a black student nigger. That's not an invitation to discuss, nor is there any discussion to be likely. It's not political speech in the sense that it's not an effort to propagate one's views about something to other people. It just doesn't involve the purposes that the First Amendment is supposed to serve, so it has virtually no First Amendment values on the one hand, and on the other side has serious antisocial mm-hmm. consequences. That being, under the fighting words doctrine, the risk of violence, which government is entitled to try and prevent. Well, we have the same sort of balance in the rule that we proposed. The speech in question had this could also appropriately be characterized as having virtually no First Amendment value. And on the other side, and this is what the rule spelled out, it would have the consequence of making the educational environment hostile for minority students and interfering with their ability to work effectively within the university. And obviously, the university has a very important interest in providing an environment in which all students can work and study effectively. So it was the same basic principle, though not the same formal requirement.
So this was at the system level. You were doing this for
right.
that system. What happened to that code after it was written?
Ultimately, the system committee was convinced to go with our far more limited proposal. And that came to the Faculty Senate too, and I don't recall the exact sequence of events, but Madison Faculty Senate also approved it.
Now, did you have any dealings that you recall or that were of any significance with our new chancellor during the drafting of this initial code?
I'm sure that we discussed it, and Donna was understood the First Amendment problems mm-hmm. posed by the much broader language in the system proposal, and was very sympathetic to the objective of drafting a far more limited code.
So this was passed by the Faculty Senate, and then it went to the Board of Regents. What was its fate there?
Well, what would have gone to the Board of Regents was the system proposal.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm sorry. Yes.
And it was very, very much debated by the Board of excuse me, by the Board of Regents, and along with others, I appeared at a couple of Board of Regents meetings to argue in favor of it, and ultimately, by a divided but fairly substantial vote, the Board of Regents approved this.
Mm-hmm. What were the arguments against it, essentially?
That it violated the First Amendment freedom of speech, which, in my judgment, is not a very sound argument. Another argument, which was, I think, certainly true, is that it would not have prevented, or would have not have applied to, some of the incidents that had led to concern about racist speech, because those were public statements, not private insults. That is, the messages were being communicated publicly. They weren't simply private insults. And therefore, that the rule would create expectations that it couldn't satisfy, and in that sense maybe do more harm than good. Now, there were a lot of arguments.
Yeah. It was very heated, as I recall.
Yeah, very emotional.
Yeah, who was the board chairman of the BOR at that point? It wasn't Weinstein, was it?
Lawrence was on the board, but I don't remember whether he was chair. No,
there was
a lawyer from Milwaukee, I think, who was chair. I can't remember. I know him, but I can't remember his name at the moment.
So it was made essentially into law. There were some challenges to that eventually. Was it the ACLU that
the ACLU brought a suit on behalf of Milwaukee campus newspaper and others, and the federal district court Judge Warren, if I recall correctly,
that's
in
right.
Milwaukee, held the rule unconstitutional for a number of reasons. Essentially, he was not prepared to go beyond the specific provisions of the fighting word doctrine. And since this was not limited to words that would provoke an immediate violent response, he found that it was invalid. In addition, and coloring the whole litigation, was the fact that there were a bunch of incidents throughout the system, not on the Madison campus, but on other campuses, in which the rules had been misapplied to speech that did not fall within its scope and should not have been subject to discipline. So that the picture that appeared before the federal district court was one in which the rule, in fact, was being used against speech that should have been deemed protected and was not subject to discipline under the rule.
What about here in Madison? Do you recall what kind of complaints were there? I assume there were some complaints that were issued about people violating the code after it occurred.
Yeah, but I don't think there were ever, in that period, any actual disciplinary proceedings. Mary Rouse's office could tell you more about
Roger
that.
Roger Howard was actively involved in that. I should really discuss this issue with him, too. So Warren overthrew it. But the BOR went back. Did they come back then and redraft it? Wasn't that or ask you to redraft it?
Then the question arose whether that decision should be appealed, whether we should just forget about the whole thing, or whether we should seek to draft a rule that would meet the objections of the district court. And Donna, the chancellor, asked our dean, Dean Bernstein, to ask some faculty members for advice on what approach we should take. Some of us, Dan asked some of us to talk about the matter. We did, and we recommended not to appeal because the whole context, factual context of the case was not a good one for appeal. That we should not simply forget about everything because that would send the wrong message to minority students as well as others, but that we should redraft, which we then did, and came up with a proposal that was indeed explicitly modeled on the fighting words doctrine, but would have been applicable regardless of the physical characteristics of the particular people involved. Because what it said was that would be likely to provoke a violent response from an average person without taking into account whether they were large or small, mm-hmm. male or female. So we modeled it on finding words but avoided that problems, and we also included an explicit, two things were new. There was an express provision which said that in the context of public statements as opposed to private insults, in the context of public statements, even the use of racial epithets was not covered. Mm. They could not be subject to discipline except in the private insult context. When used in public statements, they were immune from discipline. So we wanted to make it perfectly clear that this rule imposed no limit whatsoever on anything that could be considered public debate. And secondly, in order to avoid the problem of misapplication on other campuses, we imposed a requirement that if some incident arose on a campus, before any disciplinary action could be instituted there, the campus had to report it to.
So that was, in effect, a way of getting away from just having these frivolous things come in and clog up the system?
Well, it was a way of trying to make sure that the rule would not be misapplied.
Right, that's what essentially I meant.
Right.
So that was, I think the board passed that one 9-6 in March of 92. We're talking about 3 years.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. What happened with that?
Two things happened after the board passed it. First of all, there was a change in the composition of the regents, so that at least a couple of the regents who had voted in favor of it were replaced by new regents.
Yeah, it was 12-5 the first time, so this would be 9-6, yeah, closer.
Well, no, after this rule.
After the new rule, okay.
Two things happened.
Okay.
After it was passed by a 9-6 vote, some of the regents changed. And secondly, there was a United States Supreme Court decision which some people argued, and on the face of it, well, it was a plausible argument, but I think if you looked more carefully, it didn't hold up. But that decision was perceived as creating a huge question about whether this new rule would be constitutionally valid.
You're talking about RAV versus St. Paul.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Those two factors led the Board of Regents to reverse itself at a subsequent meeting.
Hmm.
And it withdrew the rule so that there is no rule.
Wasn't the Wisconsin Supreme Court involved? Didn't they overturn it or something?
No. The Wisconsin Supreme Court was involved with a Wisconsin law which imposed a special penalty on conduct that was otherwise criminal but was motivated by racial hatred.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a separate problem.
What happens, I assume that there was no call to resurrect the rule after that point.
No.
What happens on campus now if some of these things happen, fighting words are spoken? Is there any way that the students, is there any recourse for?
I don't think so, no. But as a practical matter, there are seldom any effective recourse because it's something that most of the incidents we heard about, the person who was insulted wouldn't have known the identity mm-hmm. of the person who was shouting the epithets. So there was no way to get at that.
Yeah, that was. OK, Okay, let's let's leave the First Amendment issues. Are there any other First Amendment issues, first of all, that you can think of that you've been involved with that you'd like to discuss?
Not that I think of offhand.
Let's talk for a little bit about some of your public service work. You've served on the Wisconsin Supreme Court Committee, and that regulates the behavior of lawyers?
Well, there are a couple of different things.
Okay.
I served on the Wisconsin, a special committee that the court appointed to review the Wisconsin rules regulating lawyer behavior and make proposals for changes in those rules.
That was in 1980, wasn't it? Around there?
Around then, yeah.
Okay.
And the committee came up with a new code of professional conduct, which the court pretty much adopted, and following that I participated in some bar activities designed to provide educational programs for the bar on the new code.
Okay. Go ahead.
And the other thing that I have served on more recently is the committee for this area that reviews complaints against lawyers, charging them with violating these rules of professional conduct and making recommendations to the Professional Responsibilities Board about whether these complaints are valid or not. This committee investigates the complaints, does some factual investigations, some legal analysis, discusses them, and then makes a recommendation on each complaint to the Professional Responsibilities Board.
When you work on something like you did in adapting this new set of rules for lawyers' behavior, were there any real significant changes that came out of that? Do you just fine-tune the already existing rules? How does that operate?
Well, this was a major change because what motivated this was the fact that the American Bar Association, which has no legislative authority but makes recommendations, had recommended a whole new code which would supplant its prior recommended rules. The prior recommended rules were adopted in virtually every state in the country. And so this was a proposal by the ABA of major significance throughout the country. And it was being considered by states all over. And many of the states adopted the new rules. Some stuck with the old rules with a few modifications. The committee here on which I served recommended adopting the new code with some of our own proposed modifications, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court adopted that recommendation with a few changes of its own. So it was a major change in the law.
The law school, I think we've talked about this briefly before, the law school, I can see, would work closely with the legislature, maybe, on various issues.
Yes.
Have you worked much with the legislature during your years here on campus?
Not really in my capacity as a law professor, but in my involvement in faculty governance issues, especially on the collective bargaining issue, I worked with, in the sense of seeking to convince members of the legislature of our position, I spent a fair amount of time working with particular legislators in that way.
So the Wisconsin idea of the connection between the university and the state capital is alive and well in the law school?
Oh, yeah.
Let's go to a minute for a little bit about your involvement in party politics.
Okay.
I don't know anything about this. You just mentioned this to me, and I wrote it down. So I believe when I interviewed Sue that she talked about her involvement in state party politics. How would you characterize yours?
Well, let me give you the background. We had both been quite active in the Democratic Party in Albuquerque, New Mexico, when we moved there, and that was my first teaching job. And there was a one-year hiatus between my teaching there and coming here when I was visiting at Rutgers in Newark, New Jersey. When we came here, we became involved in local Democratic Party politics. That was initially we became involved in the 1964 campaigns. That was Johnson versus Goldwater, as you will recall.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I recall that.
And we were active locally there, and I think it must have been 2 years later that Sue became involved as a sort of local campaign manager in Kastenmeier's campaign.
Kastenmeier is a congressman from this district for many, many, many years. He was defeated 2 terms ago by Klug.
And we were active in the Dane County Democratic Party. We both became active on behalf of the Eugene McCarthy campaign in 1968. Sue was in charge of Dane County organizational activities. I was state treasurer of the McCarthy campaign. We both were Wisconsin McCarthy delegates to the 68 Democratic Party convention in Chicago. I think, as I recall, it was after that Sue was elected chair of the Dane County Democratic Party. Now, that's a quick sketch of our involvement here.
Well, the night of the big blow-up in 68, the Democratic Convention, I remember listening to it. I was out camping out west in Utah, driving through the Utah desert, listening to all of this. These things happening in Chicago. Little did I know at that time this person I'd be interviewing some 25 years later was right there at the scene. Did you get a good... Did you know what was going on outside, inside?
Well, we knew something about what was going on outside, but we were inside.
Did you watch? Was it buzzing around the convention that?
I don't remember. As part of the blow up, I think, actually occurred before the convention convened. Mm. I'm not sure about that.
I'd have to look that up.
But to the extent that happened before, we wouldn't have been there. But there was plenty going on while the convention was in session. But we really, we were focusing on the convention itself.
On getting McCarthy nominated,
right,
which you apparently managed to do. Let's just tie it up. This is.
Say which we managed to do?
To get McCarthy nominated for the.
No.
Oh. Wait. Oh, no, I'm
Humphrey
sorry.
Was
I'm
nominated.
Sorry.
Yeah,
was
we.
God, what am I thinking?
We made a good effort,
yeah,
but we ultimately failed.
I still remember walking down. Around campus, you look in these tall dorms, and every window had a McCarthy sign.
Right.
You were convinced that McCarthy was going to be president.
Well, we managed to win the primary in Wisconsin, which was an important victory. But
yeah, he never made it. Okay, you retired from law school last year. What are your plans in the immediate future for your involvement with the school and with the practice of law and with the university?
I technically retired at the end of
Let's
May.
Let's stress that word technically here.
Yeah, I'll explain that. At the end of May 1993, but with the plan to be hired back by the law school to teach on a half-time basis, which is full-time in the fall semester, and no time in the second semester. So I did that did that in 1993, and I'm doing that right now. And I plan to continue that for the time being, whether I'll do it for another year or two or three or whatever, I don't know. I think the law school will continue to have a substantial need for what I typically do in the fall semester. And as long as I do it reasonably well, they'll be happy to have me do it. How long I'm going to want to do it, I don't really know. And as you know, Sue retired at the end of December 1993, and she retired completely. So we do a fair amount of traveling in the so-called spring semester. And instead of traveling in the summer as we used to do, we pretty much stay in Madison in the summer and do our traveling January through May.
Boy, does that make sense.
Yes, it certainly does.
Do you have any trips planned this January?
We're taking a couple of skiing trips, and we're going to take a trip to Bonaire, and we're going to take a trip to Spain in May.
Oh, my. That sounds wonderful.
So we have not found that we have any time on our hands.
Do you have any closing comments or remarks you'd like to make?
No, I don't think so.
Well, I would like to thank you very much on behalf of the UW Oral History Project for these many hours of interview time and sharing your many experiences at the UW with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Barry.
End of interview.
Okay.